The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. Has the glasnost of COVID restrictions finally begun? We heard this morning that school children may not have to self-isolate if somebody in their class gets the virus, which would be a welcome relief to the many parents, for 105,000 of them apparently, who are self-isolating right now. Is this Sajid Javid's influence already? I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Katie Bowles and James Forsyth. Now, James, Javid's been in the job 2 days, so we can't realistically think that new school advice is down to him. But it does seem to be a change in the wind, shall we say.
Well, I don't think, as you say, he's been in post for too short a period of time to say this is his effect on policy. I think what you have seen is a tonal shift from government towards a kind of more forward-leaning approach to kind of living with the virus. And I think also one of the things that you are seeing with schools with the rise of a Delta variant is that when COVID cases spike, the current school bubbles policy essentially guts education, makes it very difficult to believe that you could have like rigorous exams even next summer, and basically more and more disruption. And so I think the argument which is gathering strength is that the current policy is just too restrictive. Some of these bubbles are 100 children big. One kid testing positive is sending them all home. That's clearly not practical.
It's also never been clear to me what good it does. I mean, this policy has been in place for quite some time now, and normally you continue with the policy if it shows a measurable success. I'm not sure this...
I think this is why I think the policy was never really about protecting school children. It was about protecting teachers, parents, grandparents, right? So, you know, stopping the spread from breaking out into the community.
Almost all of whom will be vaccinated.
Exactly. And so I think you can say it should have been done sooner, but I think certainly by the time schools return in September, you know, we should be very far down the age groups when it comes to who has been double vaccinated. I look at our youthful podcast producer there, and I think, you know, it should be kind of having cascaded down the generations. And so I think at that point, the idea of rapid testing or something like that replacing the policy would be far more sensible and far more proportionate to the risk.
Katie, I wonder if the Matt Hancock debacle has led to change of perception. Previously, the political risk lay on those who were against the restrictions because they could be accused of, you know, letting the virus rip, letting people die. But now I wonder if the Matt Hancock affair has led people to think that the political risk is being too in favour of restrictions, too pro-restrictive. And that's why we can see the mood change. Politicians, after all, will go where they believe the least political risk is and the most political opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few things going on. I think the Matt Hancock situation has definitely made the government more aware of the backlash they face. But I think it's part of a wider backdrop where ultimately polling often shows that the public support an extension of restrictions, have a very cautious approach to COVID. Yet, speaking to ministers in the past week, so even before the Matt Hancock situation, you know, those photos, that video was published, were really quite worried about the fact that they were getting quite a lot of heat from their constituents on the issue of delaying that lockdown. And that 4-week delay to the 19th of July had some say to me, who aren't the usual COVID recovery group, seen as very in the middle of the party, that they thought 5th of July should go ahead because people are not happy about the delay. And I think it leans into this idea, which I think is where the Matt Hancock thing comes in, which is one rule for them, which is really gaining traction there. I think the fact that you have a situation where lots of things are allowed, if they're a government experiment, or ministers can go on business trips, and business and work seems to have a really broad definition of what you're allowed to do, means that people are getting quite fed up. And I think that's all playing into this sense that you need to move to period of things are more universal. I think that Sajid's appointment is important in this because it's just even the tone of how he is talking. When he spoke and made his debut as Health Secretary in the Commons on Monday, he was talking about case numbers and how case numbers, you know, may be rising quite rapidly, but he didn't think that was such a big deal if ultimately the chain was broken. Now, I know Matt Hancock has said similar things, but I really, having heard Matt Hancock speak many times during this pandemic, I just think there's a shift in tone. And speaking to Tory MPs today, I think that ultimately there's quite a lot of relief that Sajid Javid is now in that position. I think, as one put to me, you know, he's a very popular appointment amongst Tory backbenchers, because they do think he is someone who is more in favour of this approach of the responsibility being on the individual and moving to guidelines. I think the question is, if we're moving to guidelines, which is now the strong direction of travel, unless something completely unexpected happens, how heavy are those guidelines? Because there are some ministers and Tory MPs who worry that strong guidelines could actually mean that businesses still feel as though they have to keep some things in place.
Now, James, one place where politics is getting particularly brutal right now is the Batley and Spen by-election. We saw a leaflet emerge this morning. A Labour Party leaflet says, I'm looking at it now, don't risk a Tory MP who is not on your side. A picture of Boris Johnson shaking hands with the Prime Minister of India and basically accusing him of, Boris Johnson, of whitewashing Islamophobia and falsely accusing him of having compared Muslim women to letterboxes. Now, what is going on here? This is unusual, to basically use the alliance between the Prime Minister and India's Prime Minister as a stick to beat him with.
So this is essentially the kind of politics of Kashmir. There is a large Muslim population in Batley and Spen, which have traditionally voted predominantly for the Labour Party. But in this by-election, that has been challenged. George Galloway has turned up. He is attacking Keir Starmer, saying that Keir Starmer is, I don't quite see what the basis for this claim is, but he claims that Keir Starmer is Israel's number one supporter in the House of Commons, and he points to the fact that Keir Starmer has moved Labour's position on Kashmir, which it adopted under Jeremy Corbyn, back to being a position that Kashmir is an issue for India and Pakistan to resolve. I think this is another sign of what an incredibly ugly by-election this is becoming. You have fake leaflets being posted through letterboxes in predominantly white areas of constituency, saying things like Labour supports taking the knee, Labour believes in white privilege. You have Galloway doing what he's doing and say, and now you have this Labour leaflet, which yes, it has some quotes from Boris Johnson on, one of which is distorted, but it also, look at the picture choice which dominates the leaflet. It is a picture of Boris Johnson and Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, essentially saying, you know, don't vote for him, he's too close to the Hindus. And this is a sign of really ugly sectarian communal politics arriving in Britain. And there is something particularly tragic about this happening in a constituency where in 2016, its MP was murdered in broad daylight on the streets. By-elections often, you know, have kind of rough house campaign techniques, but it is clear in Batley and Spen that something has gone very wrong. Things are going far too far there. You've got the police out watching because people out canvassing and campaigning have been assaulted. You know, clearly things are going very wrong. And I think whatever the result of this by-election is, everyone needs to kind of take a step back and think about the country and the society that we want to be. And the fact that, you know, long after voting has ceased in this by-election, you know, people in that constituency, everyone is still going to be neighbours with one another, and people have to find a way to live together.
Katie, another little drama going on right now is whether the Hancock affair raises questions about how people communicate with each other. Our minister has been using their personal emails to send information to dodge, I don't know, freedom of information requests. What's all that about? And how come it's coming back again? Because I thought we'd worked out 10 years ago that personal emails are just as liable to FOI requests as work emails.
Yes, and I think this is linked in with ultimately questions on security. So that, I think there's a few elements to it. So one, I think, well, it began in the sense that Matt Hancock has been accused of ultimately using his private email for official business. And now other health ministers, so Lord Bethell, Helen Whateley, have also used private emails at times. Now,
Is there something wrong in doing that? That's what I can't work out. Because I thought that when this was last came up for debate in 2012, they said, yes, you can use your private emails, but don't think that makes them less visible to public inquiries.
Well, we've had ministers try and clarify this, and I think you are able to use your private email address is the current clarification, but it should only be for business that is appropriate to use your private email on. I think ultimately, if it was very confidential, highly sensitive information, the implication is you should not be using your private email, you should be using a government email. But I think using it for certain things, you know, for your diary, for things like this, it would be acceptable to use your own private email. And there's obviously a question that could still be FOI'd, but I think, because we've had a situation where everyone's talking about security in terms of this camera, which caught Matt Hancock and is why he is no longer in his position, I think there's now a question of security about should you really be using your personal email? Yes, in terms of obviously accessing information, but I think also, is it such a good idea to use a personal email with a lot less security than a government email to go about your business? And I think that's where it's heading. But I think in terms of the politics of it, I think ultimately what the opposition have been trying to do for some time, began when Rachel Reeves was the opposite to Michael Gove, she's now Shadow Chancellor, is ultimately paint an image of the government as Tory sleaze and of also skipping things, having their own rules, not playing by the rules of the system and helping their friends. And I think there's another part of this, which is private emails, even if they are allowed, I think to some voters might sound a bit like, well, why are they using that? And I think it's partly the reason they're hammering this so hard is to try and add to this sense of almost a VIP network if you know Tory MPs and therefore you have access to the private emails. But if you're anyone else, then no.
Now, James, it's you can't hardly call this a modern conundrum. I mean, Oliver North got busted in 1986 via emails. So since then, politicians have found all sorts of ways of communicating with each other. I think ever since, to me, anybody who got caught saying something stupid in email since 1986 had it coming, because that showed the world you need to be careful. Since then, politicians, everybody, you can call each other. There's all sorts of WhatsApps or text messages. There's a world of communications, and I'm surprised that we're still having this conversation. It just seems a little bit out of date.
I mean, you are right. The first thing is, all of these emails, if you are conducting government business, you're first of all meant to conduct it on your government email. But if you're conducting it on your private email, that, as you say, is still subject to FOI. If someone can find that there is an email address kind of that they can request those messages. I think the concern people would argue is that, you know, sometimes officials will be reluctant to ask a Secretary of State for access to their private emails, kind of trawl through looking for what's going on. And then there's the Hillary Clinton problem, which is, you know, people's private email accounts, as Katie said, are not devised to protect against foreign states that are trying to find out what you are saying, hacking, all of that stuff. I think it's Katie said the politics of this is Labour wants to create this narrative of one rule for them, another rule for the rest of us. I think, you know, for example, the government's announcement today about how, you know, business executives are going to make a significant contribution to the economy are going to be exempted from travel quarantine rules. You know, allowed to say, right, I'm off to make a significant contribution to the economy, so I'm leaving quarantine early. You know, that is going to annoy people because people are like, well, I'm making a significant contribution when I go and do my supermarket shop and I can't do that. And I mean, in a way, this is why I think that you and Katie's point is totally correct. The political balance on easing the restrictions is shifting now. Because I think if you want to make life easier for some things, like, you know, there's a football tonight at Wembley and there'll be 45,000 people there. And I think lots of people who would like to have a far smaller event than 45,000 people are like, well, why does the football get this? Why do the UEFA officials get to come in without having to quarantine? All of these double standards are going to rankle more and more as we get, ironically, as you get closer and closer to the end of these restrictions. So, I mean, all of these things are why life politically, I think, will be quite choppy for the government in the run-up to the 19th of July.
And Katie, the football, as James says, is about to start today. And I wish England every success now that the most promising country was inexplicably struck out of the contest to the other round. But Liam Fox has just sent a tweet saying, French UEFA officials come to UK and don't have to isolate. This means we're second-class citizens in our own country. This is a former defence secretary. He hasn't really been one of the sort of COVID hawks right
former
now.
Former international trade secretary as well, interestingly.
Yeah, and also he's also saying we are welcome in France if we've had two jabs. If we've had two jabs, we have to isolate on return from France to the UK. It seems that we are beginning to turn up the temperature, and there might be, after tonight's football and the final in Wembley, of course, in a few days' time, when there will be 2,500 UEFA people coming in the immunological Zill lanes without having to quarantine. So I wonder if we can expect more and more rebellion between now and then. If the football and all of the licenses that are being shown for the football in Wimbledon as well, you know, the no wonder the double vaxxed crowd was applauding the vaccination chief in the audience there. But people will be thinking, well, what about those who would quite like to be there but can't? I mean, I wonder if we're about to get see this explode politically in a way that we haven't so far.
I think the UEFA travel wave, which means people can ultimately come here and quarantine, and you have ministers suggesting, oh, it's practically like being in a, you know, a red list hotel, just as you get to go out and go to the football and come back. I think ultimately that is causing a lot of issues for the government, within government too. There are lots of quite senior figures and ministers who are really uncomfortable with the fact number 10 have decided to relax lists. I've heard people say that they think number 10 ultimately believe football is popular. Correct. And therefore, this would be a measure that wasn't particularly controversial. But ultimately, they're missing something here, which is the fact that, yes, people want, you know, the football to be on, to be able to go to it, but not to the point that ultimately corporate figures can just come and go while everyone else can't get on with their lives. And I think the fact that you've got people such as Fox breaking rank, I think we're going to see more of that, because it is one of those ones where I just get the sense a lot of figures, not just in the Tory party, but also in government, who worry that ministers are now so disconnected from what most people in the country are still living under, that they are ultimately getting very slack and not quite thinking through some of the impact, oh, it's just a bit of a relaxation here, is having on public morale. And I think this is a good example.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you, James. And that's going to be the cover story of a New Spectator out in a couple of days. We're going to be looking at whether the government has been arranging the football, the tennis and other Potemkin events to give a veneer of freedom when the reality is very, very different for those who want to get their own lives back on the road. Thanks for listening, and thanks to the youthful Max Jeffrey, our podcast presenter, and our thoughts with our other podcast producer, Cindy Yu, who is off on holiday touring monasteries right now in the rain.